You ever think about what it takes to be the first person to try something that everybody else is absolutely sure will kill you? I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because today's story is about a moment in aviation history that happened on this very date, April 28th, back in 1919. And it involves a young man, a silk canopy, and a question nobody had ever answered with their life on the line. His name was Leslie Leroy Irvin. And on this day, over McCook Field in Dayton, Ohio, he stepped out of a de Havilland DH-9 at about 1,500 feet and did something no human being had ever deliberately done before. He jumped, fell free through open air, and then, only after falling for several seconds, pulled a ripcord to deploy his parachute. Now that might not sound revolutionary to you, every skydiver on the planet does exactly that today. But in 1919, nobody had done it. Not once. Not intentionally, the entire concept of a free-fall parachute jump was considered by most experts to be a death sentence. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So, let me set the stage for you. The Great War had just ended, World War I, and the parachute situation during that conflict was, to be blunt, a disgrace. The Germans had fielded parachutes for their observation balloon crews and even some of their fighter pilots. The Heinecke parachute saved lives on the German side, but the British and the Americans, their aviators had almost nothing. British High Command actually argued that giving pilots parachutes would encourage cowardice, that they'd bail out of perfectly good airplanes rather than fight. So thousands of Allied airmen died in burning aircraft when a 20-pound silk canopy could have saved them. After the war ended, the United States Army Air Service knew they had to fix this. They set up a parachute research program at McCook Field, which was this little airfield right in the middle of Dayton. And the man running the show was a fellow named Major Edward Hoffman, working alongside some very sharp engineers. But the core problem they faced was simple and terrifying. See, the parachutes that existed at the time were what we call static line chutes. You'd attach a cord from the parachute to the airplane, and when you jumped or fell, the line would pull the canopy out automatically. The chute opened the moment you separated from the aircraft. And that worked fine if you fell off a balloon at 2,000 feet. But for airplane pilots, it was a nightmare. At the speeds a pursuit plane flew, even a 1918 pursuit plane, a static line chute opening instantly could tangle in the tail surfaces, rip apart from the airspeed, or yank the pilot into the empennage. Pilots were getting killed by the very devices meant to save them, so the idea emerged: what if the pilot could fall free, clear the airplane entirely, and then open the parachute manually? A free-fall jump with a ripcord. Simple in concept, absolutely terrifying in practice. Because here's the thing that had everyone spooked. The prevailing medical opinion in 1919 was that a human body in freefall would lose consciousness. Doctors and scientists genuinely believed that the sensation of falling without any resistance would cause a person to black out almost immediately. They thought the human nervous system simply couldn't handle it, that your brain would just shut off. Think about that for a second. The best medical minds of the era were telling these engineers that the moment a man started falling through the air, he'd pass out. And an unconscious man can't pull a ripcord. So a free-fall parachute was, according to science, a theoretical impossibility, a beautiful idea that would produce a very dead test subject. Now here's where it gets interesting. Leslie Irvin wasn't a doctor. He wasn't a scientist. He wasn't even in the military. He was a 23-year-old professional stunt jumper from Los Angeles. He'd been doing exhibition parachute jumps at county fairs and air shows since he was a teenager. He'd worked with a parachute designer named Floyd Smith, who had built a prototype of a freefall chute with a ripcord, and Irvin had actually tested crude versions of the concept in his barnstorming days. He knew, from personal experience, that you did not pass out in freefall. He'd done short delays before pulling his static line chutes. He'd felt the wind, felt the fall, and stayed perfectly conscious. So when the Army needed someone brave enough or maybe crazy enough to prove the concept worked, Irvin volunteered. Floyd Smith had designed the parachute, a backpack-style canopy with a manual ripcord. The Army engineers had refined it, but somebody had to jump. April 28, 1919. McCook Field. The weather was decent, not perfect, but workable. Irvin climbed into the rear cockpit of a de Havilland DH-9 biplane. The pilot took them up to about 1,500 feet over the field. And then Leslie Irvin stood up, climbed out onto the wing, and jumped. Now picture this. You're standing on the wing of an open cockpit biplane, the engine roaring, the prop wash tearing at your clothes, and you're wearing a silk pack on your back that has never been proven to work in this configuration. Every doctor in the country says you're about to pass out, and below you is nothing but 1,500 feet of Ohio air and a very hard grass field. He jumped. He fell free. No static line. No automatic deployment. Just a man in gravity. He counted. He waited. And then he reached back and pulled the ripcord. The canopy deployed. The silk mushroomed out above him, the harness caught his weight, and Leslie Irvin floated down to the field at McCook, alive, conscious, and having just changed the history of aviation forever. He did break his ankle on the landing, I should mention. The landing techniques in those days were not exactly refined, but he walked away. Well, he limped away, and the data was in. A human being could free fall from an airplane, remain fully conscious, and manually deploy a parachute. The doctors were wrong. The concept worked. The Army Air Service immediately moved forward with development. Floyd Smith's design became the foundation for what would eventually be called the Type A parachute, and later the Irving Air Chute, the standard-issue parachute that would save thousands of military aviators over the coming decades. And yes, it was spelled I-R-V-I-N-G with a G because of a clerical error when Irvin filed his company paperwork. The man's name was Irvin, no G, but his company became the Irving Air Chute Company with a G, and that typo stuck for the rest of history. You can't make this stuff up, but here's the part that really gets me. Think about what happened because of that one jump. In World War II, the Irving parachute and its descendants saved tens of thousands of airmen. Every Allied bomber crewman, every fighter pilot, every transport crew, they all carried parachutes that traced their lineage directly back to that April morning at McCook Field. The paratroopers who jumped into Normandy on D-Day, the airborne forces at Market Garden, all of it flows from the proof of concept that Leslie Irvin provided with his body. The Caterpillar Club was established for anyone who saved their life using a parachute in an emergency. You had to bail out of a disabled aircraft and survive. The club's name came from the silkworm, the caterpillar that produces the silk that made those early canopies. And by the end of World War II, the Caterpillar Club had thousands upon thousands of members. Every single one of them owed their lives, at least in part to the 23-year-old stunt jumper who proved the doctors wrong over Dayton.
Irvin himself went on to build a parachute empire. The Irving Air Chute Company became one of the dominant parachute manufacturers in the world, supplying militaries on both sides of the Atlantic. Irvin became wealthy, respected, a pillar of the aviation community, but he never stopped being a hands-on guy. He tested his own products, he jumped well into middle age. He understood, in a way that a lot of corporate executives never do, that the product had to work because lives depended on it. Not theoretical lives. Real men falling out of burning airplanes. He passed away in 1966 at the age of 70, which, considering he spent his teens and 20s jumping off of airplanes with experimental equipment, is a pretty good run. There's one more piece of this I want to leave you with. Back when Aviges was cheap and airspace was free, the idea that somebody had to be first was just understood. Somebody had to fly across the Atlantic first. Somebody had to break the sound barrier first. Somebody had to prove that a free-falling human being wouldn't just switch off like a light bulb. And those somebodies were almost never the generals or the politicians or the scientists. They were the Leslie Irvins, the young, slightly reckless, deeply skilled practitioners who said, "I've been doing this, I know it works. Let me show you." That jump lasted maybe 10 seconds of free fall, 10 seconds that rewrote the rules of aviation safety, 10 seconds that meant a 20-year-old bomber pilot over Germany in 1944 could pull a handle and live to see his family again. Not a bad legacy for a kid from California with a silk pack and no fear of falling. My sources for today's story include the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's archives on McCook Field, the parachute history research of Lee Parachute Association, and several accounts from the early records of the Irving Air Chute Company. Come find us at RadioHangar.com. Fly safe out there, and remember, somebody had to be first.